Hi, welcome to episode 34 of the Sources and Methods podcast. It's another solo episode with me. I'm talking this week with Lynn Kelly, who is the author of a new book called The Memory Code, where she talks about the idea of space-based or kind of location-based memory systems and kind of old archaeological things like Stonehenge and a whole bunch of other places. We get into all of the details of this in the episode itself. Hopefully it's self-explanatory, but I recommend if you're interested in memory skills and memory techniques, there's a lot of kind of practical ideas. And as we talk about in the blog, she has a great post on her, as I talk about in the podcast, she has a great post on her blog called 33 Memory Experiments. I strongly encourage you to take a look at that. She's got photos of all of the different kind of artifacts and things she's constructed to allow her to study and learn large bits of information and history and ornithology and all sorts of things like that. Anyway, here's the episode. Well, I mean, in terms of just kind of getting started, maybe you could just kind of describe yourself, your work, kind of your background a little bit for our audience.
I'm a researcher at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia. I've been an educator in schools most of my life, and I went back to university to do a PhD as a mature age student. And it got derailed and ended up on nothing like the topic I started.
I just finished I guess it's kind of the popular version of your book, which was like more related to your PhD. The one I read is called The Memory Code, and the PhD-derived one is called Knowledge and Power in Prehistoric Societies. Am I getting the relationship between the two right there?
Yes, Knowledge and Power was published by Cambridge University Press, so it's the academic version, because my ideas are a little bit radical and I didn't get them into journals during my PhD studies. And now The Memory Code's just come out in Australia, which talks about the same ideas that we'll talk about this evening, well, it's this evening here, for the general readership, and it comes out in America and England in February.
Could you describe, I guess, the kind of the overview in as much or as little detail as you want of your book, and maybe just kind of situate it in terms of, you know, the fact that the ideas you're presenting are quite new?
Yes, basically, I was looking at the way Indigenous cultures, in particular Australian Aboriginal cultures, record information about animal behaviour. And I started to realise that they were storing information about a huge number of animals in memory. Our Australian cultures are very, very old, but there's still hunter-gatherer or just a little bit of some sorts of farming, depends on which. We've got over 300 language groups, so it depends which one you're talking about. But they store it all in memory. And I realised this is hundreds of animals, thousands of plants. I can't remember the day of the week. So I started up. Question, how do they remember so much stuff? So my nice little PhD in creative writing as a science writer and my nice little contract for my publisher on animal behaviour and looking at it with help of Indigenous cultures suddenly got derailed completely because I could not work out how they were memorising masses of information. And that's what took me down that direction. Of course, I then added navigation and astronomy and laws, and it just got wild. Then my husband had just qualified in archaeology. We both went back to university as older people. And I started asking the same question in terms of the archaeology. If there's all this understanding of how oral cultures memorise information and these monuments, Stonehenge, Avebury, you know, other monuments right around the world were built by oral cultures who were dependent on memory, then shouldn't this research that I was doing apply to them? And sheer luck, it hadn't been applied, taken from the area of sociology, where my field normally sits, sort of, over into archaeology. And that just sent me on a completely wild few years of obsession.
How did you come to these ideas and interests first? Was it just a question of you being in Australia? I mean, you begin the book by talking a lot about this idea of songlines, which maybe you can describe to people as well. But was it purely that kind of local interest, or had this been something that had been around for you before?
It hadn't been around before at all. I was a writer, science writer, and even though my background's physics and maths and hard course stuff like that, I've got an obsession with spiders, and I'd written a book on spiders for my publisher, Alan Unwin, here in Australia, and another one on crocodiles. And I needed to introduce 23 crocodilian species from around the world, the true crocodiles and the gharial. I thought, this is going to be awfully boring if I just list them. So I'll do what, at the time in my naivety, I thought, I'll do some cutesy little indigenous stories moving around the world and introduce each of the species. And I discovered those cutesy little stories were anything but. They were the introductory level, what's taught to the children, of very specific information about the different species, and the stories varied greatly with the details of the behaviour of the different crocodilians. And that's what started me on this idea that indigenous stories were not simply cutesy stories, but in fact a method by which information could be stored, because stories are far more memorable, especially mythology, which is vivid and grotesque and violent and wild, is far more memorable than a list of scientific facts.
As I read through the book, I was kind of became more and more aware. I mean, archaeology is not something that I certainly think of very much in my own work life, and I imagine most people don't either. It became clear that, you know, the role of imagination and kind of creative problem solving in archaeology was very high. And, you know, often you'll talk about something where, you know, we only know one or two features from this particular site, let's say, and then, you know, you end up having to, you know, climb into ditches and things and imagine what sounds must have felt like at the bottom of this ditch. Could you describe a little bit about, you know, what this role of imagination in archaeology is and how you experienced it?
Yes, there's archaeology itself, and I don't disagree with any of the reports or challenge any of them, because archaeologists know exactly what they're doing. They report exactly what material objects they find and where they find them and all that sort of detail. In the PhD and Knowledge and Power, I listed 10 different aspects of these memory systems that Indigenous cultures use, which would show up in the archaeology. And in order to claim that a site such as Stonehenge is in fact specifically a memory palace, I want at least 8, if not the whole 10, of these different aspects, these indicators. There has to be public and restricted places, and I'll explain why we must have restricted information, secret information. There must be performance spaces, because all knowledge is performed in oral cultures, because dance, song, mythology are far more memorable. There must be sequenced sets of locations, because that's the way all oral cultures I explored around the world function. Memory palaces, but some as broad as the landscape, depending on whether they're settled. And there's a whole lot of other things, but there's also these handheld devices that I found the African Lukasa, or memory board of the Luba people, the Australian Aboriginal Chiringa, which is again an inscribed object that's just got abstract signs. I found these sort of devices everywhere. So I started wanting them in the archaeology as well. And that whole big pattern is what's required, not just odd little bits and pieces that I can jump to the conclusion, oh, well, it must be memory.
So in what your book is doing is you're tying together, it seems, a lot of kind of disparate things, and you're joining, making kind of connections in various places which hadn't been made before. I mean, maybe you could just describe the kind of that overall argument about memory palaces and the specific sites you covered.
Yes, they seem disparate if you're a literate person that separates, in literate societies, we separate things into separate domains and we keep our knowledge domains separate. But Indigenous cultures don't do that. They integrate everything. And that's why I had to learn from Aboriginal cultures and then from Native American, in particular, the Pueblo people, but also looking at African and Pacific cultures, how these things all work in an integrated way. So if you look at Australian Aboriginal songlines, which was the click for me, Australian Aboriginal people still move, certainly up north, still move around the landscape, moving from sacred location to sacred location. And at each of those locations, and these were often quite close to each other, they would perform a ritual. Now, a ritual is a repeated event. And so they would repeat a song or a dance or a story at each location. Some of the research shows that about 70% of those songs were about practical stuff, knowledge of plants, animals, seasons, weather, where to find the best stone for napping, how to find water holes, things that are essential like that. So essentially they had a memory palace, a method of Loki as known from the, I don't know how you pronounce Loki, everybody pronounces it differently.
Yeah.
Trails. The Inca had Keks, C-E-Q-U-E-S. All cultures had the same idea of broad landscape sets of shrines, sacred places, where they performed the information. And so when I happened to be at Stonehenge with my husband, I was wanting to get to Jane Austen's house in Bath, but he wanted to go to Stonehenge because he just qualified in archaeology. I just thought to myself, what's going to happen when they're settling, when they haven't got the built environment of the Greeks and Romans, but are not still wandering right around the landscape as Indigenous cultures that move seasonally are? And I thought, well, the logical thing is to localize those song lines, localize those sets of locations in a circle is the obvious way to do it because a lot of the information is seasonal over the annual cycle. But localize sequences of places using posts or stones in order to make sure they do not lose that information. And then they'd also have all the other aspects that I know from Indigenous cultures. And that's what I found in the archaeology.
I was amazed to read of all of these different examples, particularly these stones or posts, I guess, in France that you describe. And it seems much more common a phenomenon than I'd ever, remembered or learnt of in the past.
Yeah, that was one of the things. Self-doubt ruled me for a number of years because why would I have seen something that others hadn't? So the assumption was, as a science thinker, that other people had seen it and dismissed it for good reasons. And if I'm right about Stonehenge and Avebury and the 1,000 stone circles all over the British Isles, that same logic must apply right round the world because the human brain, we're only talking 5,000 years ago, we're not talking great evolutionary changes.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is not that these cultures had any contact with each other, but that they used the memory methods that are the most effective for humans. And so then in order to argue the case, I had to show it for sites all around the world. So the one in France, Karnak, spelt C-A-R-N-A-C, not the Karnak with a K, in Brittany in France, has over 3,000 standing stones in rows, plus the restricted sites. I better explain about restricted knowledge. Plus, the cairns, passage cairns, where you can go in and hide, plus circles, and no explanation for them, but they fit the same pattern. The reason cultures must have restricted sites is the so-called Chinese whispers effect. Because if information is just generally chatted about, it can get corrupted. So the stories they tell children, which are the only ones we hear because we're not initiated, are just the general ideas and to give you the structure and the characters and so on. And then with initiation, you get more and more and more restricted information until the most senior elders will hold information that's very restricted. And it's restricted in order to keep it accurate. So some of the research shows that things like long-term survival skills, things they've learned from 100 years ago that may not have happened within right. living memory, agreements between tribes, landscape divisions between who has resource rights, the way the landscape changes, are all held at that very, very high level so that it doesn't get corrupted and they keep checking against each other. And there's examples from Australia of information on landscape changes that date back thousands of years that have been accurately held. And these were recorded, the stories and information were recorded before the science showed that they were accurate.
You kind of write of various stories of people knowing, you know, what was under a particular bed of land or a river or something like this, and they could describe something which they would have no way of knowing otherwise.
We know of Port Phillip Bay near Melbourne, the Yarra River that goes right through Victoria here, then goes out into the bay, but science didn't know that. The Aboriginal people were telling them exactly the route of the river, and it last dried out probably 10,000 years ago, although possibly 1,000 years ago. But their description of the route of it was absolutely accurate, because that's a land division between two different language groups. So they kept that in their information system because it's part of their legal system. So it wasn't shown. At very least, it's 1,000 years. They have kept that description of exactly where that riverbed is absolutely accurate. There's other ones right around the coast to do with islands that weren't islands, changes in forest types and all sorts of wonderful things. But the landscape is their primary memory palace. So that's what you would expect the very long-term information to be.
Did you take anything away, and you hinted about this a little bit earlier, in terms of kind of persevering with self-doubt, theories which perhaps were unpopular? I mean, in the book you describe essentially working on two PhDs simultaneously, right?
Yes, I did keep my original one of retelling stories, going out as a natural history writer, looking at the behaviour of, say, the wedge-tailed eagle, which is one of the origin characters for the Aboriginal culture around this area, and then looking at the Dja Dja Wurrung stories about Bunjil, as his character name is for them, and seeing if I would see more in that behaviour. It was working a treat. My publisher wanted the book. Everything was going beautifully when I stumbled over these ideas. So I kept the two going for 3 years and expecting it to fall over. In the end, my husband just said, he couldn't cope with the self-doubt any longer. We couldn't afford a psychiatrist. We were going to England. And I booked a interview with Dr. Ros Cleal, who's an expert on Stonehenge and Avebury. And she had to accept the interview because I was coming from university, and she granted me 1 hour, because you can imagine how many Stonehenge theories people want to throw at her. So we turn up, we had our hour, she had a minder there to get rid of me, I think that was his role, and at the end of 4 hours she asked us to come back the next day, and we went for another 4 hours, and she said, there is no elephant in the room, this is a new way, it's worth pursuing. And that's when I gave it up. But when you make claims like that, you have to do it very thoroughly. So it was still another 3 years till I met with her again, until the PhD and the Cambridge book were published.
How has it been received, either in general or from the kind of the various academic and knowledge communities?
I have yet to have anyone fault the theory. It's been received very well. There are some that are quiet about it, but the book, as you'll see if you've seen in the front of the memory code, is endorsed by big-name archaeologists here, Ros Cleal in England, and there's a lot about America in it. William Leip, who's endorsed it, he was also one of my examiners, is a very big-name archaeologist there. So the archaeologists who have read it have been very positive about it. A thinking like this takes a while. The memory community love it. The Indigenous community in Australia have been really keen on it. And we're looking at implementing these ideas in education, combining their way of learning, because they ground everything by grounding it in memory palaces in the landscape and handheld devices. It just works a treat, and it's so good fun that I've now got grants to implement these ideas in various educational settings. So education, lots of people have responded really positively. This is actually my last talk after 6 months or 5 months of doing lots of talks. I have yet to have anyone who doesn't like it.
Mm-hmm. In terms of kind of structuring information, I mean, there are various kind of hints and clues, and we'll get onto your own practical experience of this in a second. But, you know, obviously, if you're working with a physical object, it would seem that you would have to have structured and organized and have thoroughly understood your material before you start, you know, associating it with physical objects. Can you talk a little bit about this and what this means in terms of how you work or how people may have worked with these physical objects in the past?
There's a big difference between how people would have worked with it in the past and how I work with my versions of them when I'm experimenting with them. The big difference being they've got elders and their versions of it have evolved, and I haven't got elders. I've got to structure the information myself, trying to copy what I understand of what they're doing. So if you look at, say, the memory board of the Luba people in West Africa and Central Africa, that's been well documented as a memory device, they use the object, which is essentially a piece of wood, which is either carved or it has shells and beads attached to it, and the back is also carved. And they then, as they touch each object or each point on it, they will tell the stories or sing the songs and so on. And then they'll do layer upon layer. So the first layer might be the history of the Luba Kingdom. The next layer, they'll start to add more information higher and higher. Those that have documented it have been initiated to the first level. So we don't have a lot of details of any higher levels, and there are none, to my knowledge, there are no of those high-level Lukasa users left now, which is really sad. We've got the equivalent without Churinga here in Australia. That's either spelt C-H-U-R-I-N-G-A or T-J-U-R-I-N-G-A. And these are wooden or stone objects, again, with a whole lot of designs on them. And again, the elders will touch the men, and they're very restricted objects, will touch each portion of it and sing the appropriate songs. But they've learnt their information structured from their elders and been improved over millennia, but also adapted. Oral cultures do not stay static. So they will add new information, adapt old information, depending on what's happening. So it's quite extraordinary.
And I guess that's a little like you say that these kind of thousands of stones in Karak, your hypothesis in the book was, at least as far as I can remember, was that they had been added to over time. It wasn't that they were all installed all at once.
Yeah, well, that's what the archaeologists say, and I'm not going to argue with them. So that's logical that possibly more people added some as they learned each time, because you've got quite a large community in the Neolithic in Brittany at that time. And yes, changing is constant. So if you look at the change is constant, I know what I mean. If you look at the artwork of Australia, we've got some of the longest, the oldest continuous art tradition. And they are constantly touching it up, but also adding things. So right up north, which is where the longest art tradition, rock art tradition, has been mapped, you get the macassans, the fishing boats from Indonesia that were coming after a trepang, a sort of sea animal here, getting added on top of the rock art a couple of hundred years ago because they were being added into the story, into the oral tradition, into the knowledge system. So things are changed and updated, but the basic structure isn't.
You have a really fascinating blog, and one of my favorite parts of it is this page, which anyone who visits will find pretty easily. It's clearly signpost 33 memory experiments that you've made. Could you describe a little bit your kind of personal experience of experimenting around with some of these techniques, and I guess just in general, you know, how this has influenced or affected your life and your understanding of things?
It's changed my life completely. I'm up to 35 experiments. I must update that page. What I've tried to do is take each of the sorts of devices and the sorts of information and start trying it myself. It started basically because I didn't believe the research. I couldn't believe that a series of landscape locations, because I wasn't into the memory community at that time and I'd never tried memory palaces, and I couldn't believe that a set of memory locations would work so effectively. I actually came from the songlines, then realised that it was a Greek and Roman method. I didn't go the other way. The same happened with the Lukasa, the memory board of the African Luba people. I couldn't believe that a little handheld bit of wood with some beads and shells stuck on it could actually work as an effective memory device. So I made one. I didn't structure it according to the information. It would probably be even more effective if I did. I just glued on the beads and shells and things, what I thought looked pretty, and then started encoding. And I encoded the 408 birds of my state in taxonomic order. So I sing, as I touch the beads, I sing their scientific family name, Anatidae, Pedicipodidae, all these sort of things. And then I add into that all the animals, all the birds in that group. So Anatidae is the Anatids, the ducks. There's 16 of them. So I've added a story to that bead, which I happen to be touching now because I can't, it's just so natural. I've added a story linking the 16 names of those ducks, and I'm now adding more and more information about identifying them. This board works sensationally. It really is just a memory palace in miniature. But it's strange the things that happen when I'm using it to add this practical information and more and more and more, because things start to become more like the Indigenous stories. Let's take the Laridae, the gulls and terns.
Right.
In there, we've got the seagulls or silver gulls that I think are right around the world on the beaches. And then there's the bigger ones called the Pacific gull and the kelp gull. And the Pacific gull has a bit of red on the tip of its nose and the kelp gull doesn't. Otherwise, they look almost identical. So my story became about the specific gull who was always drunk, and that's why he's got a red nose, mm-hmm. and the kelp gull who's a health fanatic. And in my stories, they're brothers if they're the same genus. So these brothers argue about, you know, why shouldn't I get drunk and have fun, or what, you know, no, you're better off on the health kick, and those sort of debates.
Yep.
When I'm thinking of them as characters, they have a human form in my head. When I think of them, when I'm down the beach identifying, they become the birds. So they're morphing constantly. And this happens in Indigenous stories all the time. So Bunjil, the wedge-tailed eagle that I talked about before for the people in the Kulam Nation and our local Jajawarring people, the only painting of him is actually in a human form. So my stories start to get these ethical aspects to them. But the other thing is that I tried to force them to have a beginning, middle, and end.
What do you mean by that?
Normal stories that we're used to in Western culture have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
So I wanted my story of the gulls as actually more than the two I mentioned. But thinking of the two I mentioned, I wanted that story to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So they started arguing, this is what happened, and won. It just stopped being like that. These characters just were part of the world and playing around. And Indigenous stories if you read the originals, tend to be a little bit strange in that way, in that they don't have a straight linear narrative unless they're translated for Western cultures in which that's added into them.
I mean, a lot of your memory experiments seem to interact with each other, and I suppose that's not strange, completely strange, in that, you know, systems of knowledge are interlinked. It's just kind of the way our society and culture, I guess, likes to separate things out. But could you describe a little bit, you know, the ways in which the various, you know, perhaps the playing card system interacts with your history timeline or you know, that those kind of interactions and the way that one will influence the other or influence your experience of the other?
Yes, let's take three, the cards I'll get to in a moment. I have a history timeline, starts in prehistory. If I leave my front gate at 4,500,000 years ago and I walk around the block, I get back home at 1,000 years ago, and then I walk around another much bigger block and get home at 1900, and then I have every year right around the garden and the house. So that I have placed things in history. So if you say 1200 AD to me, my brain goes to the corner of Randall's Lane, where I've got King John on the throne in England. I've got Great Zimbabwe flourishing over in Zimbabwe. I've got the Song Dynasty, two countries and independent protectorates in the world. So I've got all the countries. So if I'm thinking of Great Zimbabwe, do I think of Zimbabwe itself, which is on my front porch, or do I think of the history line? It doesn't matter. Whatever I add to it, if I hear something on the news about Zimbabwe, it sort of just gets added at the right place. It all just works and interacts, and my brain has... Right, so at any point, I might be thinking about one of those ancestors, and there I can hook almost anyone off them because I've got economists and scientists and so on. I can hook them into countries. It just all weaves together, and that's the way Indigenous cultures work. They don't separate at all. It's all integrated, and all their memory devices are also integrated.
Why, I guess, just kind of posing the skeptic's question, you know, why do we? How does it help you to have this history timeline in your head? Why do we need to know these things by heart?
Because you can't see the patterns otherwise, and I just had no idea about that before I tried this. It's not that it's rote learning. It's not like looking up Google, because to look up Google, you need to know what you're looking up. I start to ask questions, and now that I've got a complete field guide to the birds, for example, my husband's a birder. We were out the other day, we saw a honey eater, which is the biggest group of birds in Australia. There's 36 of them in Victoria, and we saw one that he didn't know, and he knows most of them. And I could give him a complete list and he could eliminate down. Without a complete list, you can't do that. But more important, he started asking, why are these birds in the same family, ones he wouldn't have put together? We'd start looking at habitats, and all sorts of patterns emerge. The same happens with history, because you're looking at a particular time all over the world. I'm starting to see patterns and ask questions that I just would never have done if I didn't have this bulk of grounded information to start with.
Do you feel that we've lost something in the way that kind of modern culture approaches memory? And does that have a kind of any implications for education, do you think? Or do you think that...
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just gone in one way and that's how it is.
Absolutely. Literacy is wonderful. I'm an author. I love reading. And it gives us a depth and a permanence. But it also makes us rely on a secondary storage. And I think we've gone, I don't know about education elsewhere, but here we've gone to a lot of group work and projects and all this sort of thing without this grounded information stored in. Plus we have little kids singing and dancing and making up stories, and then as they get older they behave and sit sensibly. That's what we're going to be working on. There's funding for primary school and secondary school here, and we're setting up what's called the Orality Centre in Castlemaine, where we're going to start embedding song lines. So the children at Malmesbury Primary School are going to be initiated in by setting up a timeline that starts in 1850, which is just before Malmesbury was settled, so still in Aboriginal times, and then the gold rush came. And they'll walk it with their parents and grandparents, who'll say, you know, we're up to, you know, 1960, that's where I was born, and start telling them the stories to give them a connection to that school landscape. But we'll also add the history into it if, you know, well, the English teacher's already talking about making characters for the language rules. They're going to sing their science and tell stories about their mathematics and use these devices, but for the regular curriculum. We're not going to add another subject or memory. We're going to embed it. The music and art is going to move away from being little subjects we do in their spare time to being, why not create characters that tell their science or tell their history? Why not walk the landscape with their grandparents and learn history from them and have them feel important in the school? So that's the experiment. We've got a secondary school working on it too. Where we're going with this, I don't know, but boy, we're excited.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems, and I can definitely imagine from the perspective of children, it's a far more personal approach to memory and to the information that we hold important versus, you know, reading it in a textbook or, yeah.
Yeah, so they'll make up songs. The art teacher intends them at the beginning when they come at the school to make a couple of clay figurines, and those characters become their characters, but the other kids in the school have their characters, and they'll make up stories with theirs and their friends' characters in classes just as background fun. Why not?
What do you make of kind of memory sports groups and the kind of subculture which is developed around, you know, people learning packs of cards and so on? Do you wish they were learning kind of more interesting and diverse things or channeling those energies into other things?
No, I think they're great. I went to the Australian Memory Championships for the first time about 2 weeks ago. It turns out, as a mature age woman, that if I enter next year, every event I enter, I'll take out the Australian Senior Female Championship. So I've been training already. No, that's fun. Some people, I don't happen to be a natural competitor because I don't handle stress that well, but some people love competition. Why not? Why can't we at schools have memory competitions just the way we have chess, sport, all the rest? So for those people who are competitive, why not play around with it that way? It's an international, the World Memory Championships are on at the moment. It's fun. And no, I think that the skills they learn there can also be used in education. I don't see it as an and or. I see it as both, because my life has changed now that I have this body of information. When I watch the news, it's not just obscure places. I can hook everything onto something I've already got. It works well. So now I'm all for memory championships.
Just to switch gears for a second, you've written a number of books now. Research is an important thing to you, and you've been doing it for a long while. Do you have any particular patterns that you go through when you're, whether in terms of note-taking or the writing process? Maybe you could kind of talk our audience through a little bit about how you go about writing books and research.
Yes, I have very much my own method. The Memory Code is my 16th book. One's a novel, but the rest are all nonfiction. I have exercise books. I have to use 5mm grid books. Do you know what I mean by that? Like a graph.
Yeah, kind of square grid.
Little square grids. I cover them in different coloured paper and plastic to make them survive my work. And then I use those grids to write my notes and lie out all the information. Then I work to the computer. But I carry those notebooks with me everywhere and little boxes with ticks and so on, and keep getting annotated, because I play with the ideas. And the other thing I always do is talk about them endlessly to anyone who'll listen, because the questions people ask are what drive a book and what helps you know what you're not explaining, because it's so easy for a nonfiction writer to make certain assumptions of things that are very familiar to themselves. So I have my notebooks with me, I talk about them, and then eventually I'll go to the computer.
But you're not storing your notes digitally in any way, or kind of converting them later on?
No, if I lost, I'm up to probably 100 of these exercise books, all in their coloured things, all coded and everything. If I lost them, well, it's now gone across to the computer in terms of they've fed the books, but they've got a lot in them that aren't on computer. And no, that's a worry. We do scan, my husband and I do scan the ones that have got a lot in them that I haven't managed to use in a book yet or convert. So I scan some of them, but no, mostly they're on paper because that's what works for me. And I like sitting around having them with me everywhere because I'll get ideas in the weirdest places.
Sure. And are you then kind of writing out quotes from books and papers that you're reading there as well?
Yes, and I'll often print things and paste them in so they all crinkle, the books. I like sound. I like the feel. I paste things in from if people handwrite. If somebody's trying to tell me something, I get them to handwrite it in little notebooks I carry with me, cut it out and paste it in, because now that I've never thought of this before, but the way each one looks makes it more memorable. So those notebooks are a lot more than just the information in them. They're a record of how the ideas evolved. And I always write down who's said things and when they've said them, because a book isn't something that you do by yourself. I polish my ideas off a whole group of people. So when I came up with this theory that seemed, I've solved the mystery of Stonehenge, what rubbish, I then took it to various groups, in particular the Australian Skeptics, and said, this is what I'm going to argue, pull it to bits, and got people just to question and question and question me. Other people are invaluable for getting you polishing the way you write a book.
Was the PhD any different in any way in terms of your process?
Yes, because I was part of the academic process, which was very valuable too. It forced the rigor. But also I came from a math science background. My degrees are in engineering and information technology and things like that. And I was doing a PhD in humanities as a science writer. But it was a creative writing PhD, which was a bit weird. So I was going to seminars with humanities people who were so different from anything I was used to. They knocked some of my rigor,
rigidity?
Thank you. Rigidity. Softened that, I knocked some of their obscurities. There were some seminars where I couldn't even understand the title. And I'd be asked certain questions. I'd say, could you define your terms? No, we don't define our terms. We want free thinking. Well, I couldn't cope with that. But that blend really, really worked well for me because I was constantly being exposed to ideas that were very unfamiliar to me. So, and then of course the academic process, which is tedious, but I could have written the memory code probably 5 years ago, but I don't think it would have had the authority that a PhD and a Cambridge University Press book gave it. I think that rigor was essential, but the interdisciplinary nature, I ended up not doing a creative writing PhD, it became a purely academic PhD. It doesn't fit in any discipline, which caused a lot of problems for my supervisor, who was amazing. And then we had the big decision, do we get it assessed by somebody who'll be very easy on it, or do we go for the names of archaeologists in particular who will be extremely harsh, but if they pass it, the names will be invaluable. We went for the harsh, which was very scary, and it's paid off big time. So the academic process was wonderful. I still used my notebooks and all that exactly the same, but I was made to conform a lot more, which did me the world of good.
Aside from the kind of upcoming publication in the US and in Europe and in the UK and so on, what's up next for you?
Sleep. I had not allowed for the reaction I would get to this book. And every day I'm getting emails and messages and that from totally disparate disciplines. There are aged care people who, there's recent research showing that elderly with dementia and that, if you take them back to the places where they grew up or play music familiar to them, they will come back to life and be much more active. How much is what we're doing taking people away from their song lines, as I would say in Australia, and away from their music, doing damage? If we introduce these methods in education and people set up their memory palaces and sung their music and kept that going right through life, have we got a way? Is our increase in dementia partly that we're not doing that anymore? And it seems that Indigenous cultures have done it for thousands and thousands of years. I'm getting so many approaches from so many different people. An archaeologist from Göbekli Tepe in Turkey that I only mention in passing in the book, who's saying, you've explained this, that and the other that I didn't even know about. The reaction has been so overwhelming that I need a break, and I've got a few weeks break before I head for America. I haven't started on a new book. At the moment, I'm loving the memory experiments. I'm going to play with them. I'm going to do the education consultancies I've got for next year and let the world settle a bit before I decide what's next apart from that.
That's great. How can people stay in touch with your work and what you're writing and so on? Where can they find you online or offline?
The best is my website, which I hope to blog much more regularly now that things theoretically are going to calm down, which is www.lynnekelly.com.au, because I'm Australian.
Thank you so much for your time. This has been a really fascinating conversation. I'd certainly recommend people interested in the audience in memory and so on go and read your book and your website and so on. It's a great resource.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.